Understanding Addiction and How to Treat It. It's no secret Maine has a drug problem. For those who find themselves addicted to heroin, prescription drugs, or any other substance, the consequences can be devastating. They can lose their jobs, their families, and their own lives. The costs untreated addictions have on society can be measured in terms of higher demands on the state's healthcare system, on social services, and on law enforcement. I'm Erwin Gratz, and today we'll talk with people who've experienced addiction firsthand, who treat the disease, and who are trying to change public perceptions about people who struggle with addiction. We'll look at how to recognize addiction and how to treat it. We'll also explore the public policies that are being crafted to deal with the problem. Addiction, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Erwin Gratz, and this is Maine Calling. As many of you know, we've been airing a special series of reports this week from Susan Sharon on opiate addiction. If you missed the first two parts, they're available online at news.mpbn.net. Part three will be heard later today on Maine Things Considered, and again tomorrow in the 8 o'clock hour of Morning Edition. Opiate addiction, of course, just one facet of the larger problem of substance abuse, which we are here to talk about today. Dr. Stephen Castles has spent his medical career in helping those in need. Through his work in emergency medicine and addiction medicine, he has seen the price addiction can take on individuals from all walks of life. In an attempt to convey the devastating toll addiction can have on a person, a family, and a community, Dr. Castles turned to fiction. He wrote the murder mystery Addiction on Trial, Tragedy in Down East Maine, as a way to reach people who otherwise may not give much thought to the problem of substance abuse. Dr. Castle joins me in the studio today, along with Michelle Morin. She's a registered nurse who has worked with patients in treatment for drug abuse. Of course, we'd like to hear from you, too. What do you think should be done to help those addicted to drugs? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet us at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And welcome to both of our guests today. Dr. Castles, let me start with you right at the beginning. How big a problem is addiction in the state of Maine?
Well, I think if you look at the statistics, and I'm not a statistics guru, but you'll see that, in fact, Maine has one of the highest levels of prescription drug abuse in the nation. And more than 7% of babies born are addicted to opiates, opiates being heroin, Oxycontin, and other substances such as that. Fatal heroin overdoses quadrupled just in the year from 2011 to 2012, and drug-induced deaths exceed the national rate and certainly exceed the number of people who die in automobile accidents. So Maine certainly has a significant problem, but I don't think we ought to just isolate Maine. This is a problem up and down the East Coast as well. And if you follow what's going on in Massachusetts and Vermont, you'll see that they as well have significant problems.
Michelle Morin, is that what you're seeing too in your practice as a nurse at Merrimack River Medical Services?
Yes. Our patients, they're people that you would know. They're people you see every day. They struggle with with addiction, and they're just trying to work within the framework to overcome that and carry on with their lives and become productive members of society and work through their recovery. And we help them with that.
It's an interesting point. When you mentioned that these are people that we would know, and a lot of times addiction does seem to cross socioeconomic lines. What does that tell us about opiate addiction or drug addiction in general?
Well, I don't think that it has any particular group of people that it targets. It can be anyone, and each individual is different. So it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status is or whether you come from a family that's educated or professional, it really is an individual thing, just as with with anything, it's either going to affect you a certain way or it's not.
And I think, if I may add, excuse me, I'm fighting a little bit of a cold here. If I can add, is that it really is a disease that has no socioeconomic barriers. If you look at the fact that an aide to Boston's former mayor, Menino, was arrested for opiate possession, and a New Hampshire elementary school principal was arrested, and there's Philip Seymour Hoffman, and there's Janis Joplin, and John Belushi. I mean, we could go on and on. But I think what's really important is those are the people who we read about in the newspapers. But what we don't read about is the 80 folks from Maine who died in 2012 from drug overdoses. We don't talk about this young woman, high school senior in 2004, who died from an overdose of heroin and was a very, very good student and an athlete. And I guess what we need to do is we need to put the faces onto the disease of addiction. As Tip O'Neill, the former representative in Washington, said that all politics is local, I would like to say that all addiction is local, and that I've treated IRS agents, college students, college professors, your local carpenter, your plumber. And typically when I give a little talk and I ask people in the audience, raise your hand if you do not know a heroin addict, most people raise their hands. And when I talk to them about the fact that I think most of them do know a heroin addict, they just don't know who that heroin or OxyContin or opiate addict is.
Now, you've said a couple of times during that response, you talked about the idea of addiction as a disease, which is a theme that has recurred over the last few decades that I've been covering this as a story. But as a society, we don't yet treat this as a disease, do we?
That's an interesting question. And a lot of times I will stay away from characterizing of the disease because I know it turns people off to some degree, because there is a segment of our society that wants to believe that if something is self-inflicted, it's not a disease. Excuse me, I'm sorry. But if we look at things like diabetes, for example, and if you eat the wrong foods and you're sedentary and you develop obesity, we give that person insulin and we say they have the disease of diabetes, albeit self-inflicted. You can say the same thing of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, emphysema, asthma, for example. That's a self-inflicted illness, but we treat those people. We don't limit their medications, and we call it a disease. Let's step away from a minute, and let's say that we don't want to call addiction a disease. I personally believe it is, and it has some biological, psychological, and sociological components, and I can get into that if we have time. Certainly there's studies that show there's a genetic predisposition. But having said that, let's pretend for a minute you don't want to believe it's a disease. I don't think you can argue with the fact that even if you don't want to believe that heroin addiction is a disease, once people start using it, they develop diseases, and those diseases need to be treated. And you can't treat diseases in an individual unless you take them out of their withdrawal symptoms and unless you give them the psychosocial support and counseling that they truly need.
Well, let me turn to you again, Michelle, and just ask, kind of to follow up on that discussion, are people who need it getting the treatment that they need at this point? How easy or difficult is it for folks to obtain the treatment?
Well, I think there are a lot of options out there with different types of treatment. You have some patients opt to do a residential treatment. There's intensive outpatient treatment where patients can go and spend more time each day, but yet they're living as an outpatient. Our treatment is outpatient treatment where patients come every day. I know there are some barriers with getting reimbursement for the patients. It is the most affordable form of treatment is methadone treatment at this point for the patients, and there is also the Suboxone treatment that is a little bit more costly. So there are a lot of options out there, but monetarily it does prove to be a barrier for patients that way.
Are there also barriers because of the public attitude toward addiction? Are people afraid to come for treatment?
Well, I believe so. I know what I see, what my patients tell me is that, you know, there is a shame, there's a stigma. Even once they take the step to come into treatment, it's a big commitment because for our patients, they do come every day and they do have counseling. So they have to spend time doing that as well. They do come from far away, many of them. So transportation is also could be a huge barrier for some patients. But they come at all different phases of their recovery. Some patients are successful the first time around. Some patients have all the best of intentions to be successful, and they relapse and leave treatment. Then sometimes we see them again. Sometimes they come because they're pressured by their family. So for that reason, they might not be really completely ready. But at least they're being exposed to treatment, and they're coming, and they're getting a helping hand. We try to meet them where they are. And hopefully it's enough for them to, if they can't be successful this time, to maybe come back and try again, because we do see that as well.
Dr. Castles, let me ask you, you were talking before about talking to audiences of people and asking them if they know heroin addicts, and it seems that fewer people acknowledge that they know a heroin addict than might actually know one. Talk a little bit about the signs of addiction. How does one self-understand that they've become addicted, or how perhaps might an outsider, a family member, or other loved one see a sign that says this person needs treatment?
That's a great question, Erin. Excuse me again. That's a great question, and I think it's a multifactorial answer. If you're talking about a young person, a teenager, for example, what are some of the signs of addiction? They're changing their friends. They're hiding in their room. They're involved in activities they wouldn't normally be involved in, maybe just going to concerts and no longer participating in sports. Their grades may fall. But you could have Grandma Tilly, who all of a sudden decides not to come to the family Christmas party or holiday party. And that's because she's become what in lay terms, we would call a closet alcoholic. Or you might have the person who is a carpenter or a plumber, or for that matter, a nurse or a doctor, who is struggling financially, albeit they have good income stream, and they're working. And in fact, what's happening is they're spending their money on drugs, and they can no longer afford some of the other aspects of life. And so there's a whole variety of, shall we say, signs that might occur that a family member might pick up. As somebody who has a disease of addiction, though, not myself, but before somebody who has the disease of addiction, although I think I do to M&Ms and to tennis, but is that denial is a very, very important component of addiction. And until you break through that aspect of denial, which is why counseling is so important, that in fact people continue on that same path of use of drugs to excess.
Michelle, do you have anything you want to add to that? No is okay,
no,
too.
No, he's right.
All right. Okay, that's cool. Tell you what we're going to do. Let's go ahead and take a break. A reminder, if you want to be in touch with us here, we'd be happy to have you join this conversation. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mppn.net. You can tweet us at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Again, we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have some more comments and perhaps your questions, too. Stay tuned.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, handling over 1 million pounds of recyclables daily in the state of Maine. Casella, giving resources new life.
This week on Morning Edition, we have an extraordinary look inside Iran. We're listening to people in a country on the verge of change.
I have been crying within myself sometimes to see such huge opportunities in this country, the benefits of which should go to the people.
What a more open Iran could mean for the world. Tune in to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Please join us for Morning Edition weekdays from 6 to 9 here on MPBN Radio. Due to the winter weather, all the high school basketball tournament games originating out of Augusta today have been canceled and are being rescheduled. MPBN Television's coverage of the games originating in Bangor, however, will continue as planned, starting at 2 o'clock this afternoon on our primary HD channel. Our digital MPBN 4 channel, where it's available, will carry the Bangor games on a 3-hour delay. And a reminder that the PBS NewsHour can be seen an hour earlier at 6 this evening and also later at 10 on the World Channel.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, Addressing Addiction. With me in our studio, Michelle Morin, a registered nurse who works at Merrimack River Medical Services. Stephen Castles is the medical director of Community Substance Abuse Centers and the author of Addiction on Trial, Tragedy in Downeast Maine. Again, we invite you to join our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the phone now is Amanda, who is actually in treatment and wanted to spend a few minutes enlightening us about what she's been going through. Amanda, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Tell us a little bit about your story.
Okay, so I first entered treatment when I was 18. That was my first methadone clinic. Now, to how I got to that place, becoming a heroin addict was something that I never thought would have happened to me. I was an all-around state champion gymnast. I traveled the country competing in gymnastics. I had a fairly good childhood. Not too many things were great, but, you know, it wasn't so bad. And then I fell into the lifestyle of addiction once I became a teenager. Everything that Dr. Castles had mentioned about the signs of addiction was so right on. I withdrew from my family. I changed my friends. I quit gymnastics. I changed all of the good things in my life, you know, grew to my heroin addiction. Anyway, that's not why I'm calling. I'm not calling to talk about that. I'm calling to talk about, you know, why treatment has been so good for me. I never thought that I would be in the place that I am in now. Never thought that I could change. I went through many forms of therapy treatment. I was on Suboxone. I went back to methadone, and it wasn't until I entered Merrimack my last time, which was my fourth or my fifth time, you know, trying to break the cycle. And it wasn't until I became serious with wanting to change my life. And if it wasn't for the help of the people at Merrimack, I never would have been able to do that. This is a place where I can, you know, I was going every day. I now have a take-home status, so I only go in one day a week. But for the first, you know, few years, I had a place to go every day, which gave me stability. And that stability was something that I had never had before.
So it actually sounds like it was kind of making those human connections with the people at the treatment center were
exactly
almost as important as the treatment.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And meeting and working with my first counselor, she was an amazing woman. And it wasn't until I started working with her with, you know, the underlying issues that were causing my addiction. you know, that I was able to really make that change. And she helped me see that. And unfortunately, because of budget cuts, she's no longer there. And I wish that she could still see this transformation, but unfortunately she could not. But it's like, from what the governor is trying to do is put, you know, limits on, you know, addiction treatment, or have people switch over to Suboxone. Suboxone sometimes doesn't work for people, as methadone sometimes doesn't work for people. Everybody needs their own, you know, tailored program for them to succeed. And this was the form that I needed. And I don't know, this was the last chance that I had, pretty much. And it wasn't, you know, until I got serious with wanting to change my recovery was I able to.
Some thoughts from our guests?
Well, I would just like to thank Amanda for calling in. For those who are listening, they may think, well, this is an unusual story. And from my 30-plus years of practicing emergency medicine and addiction medicine, I can honestly say this is not an unusual story. That the success that we've just listened to is not uncommon. The fact that sometimes it takes people 2, 3, 4 times of going in and out of treatment until they find success is not uncommon. I think what's been elucidated here, the fact that we have a woman who's worked her way into employment and from being a heroin-addicted teenager, shows that treatment works and that the cost of not treating is significantly higher than the cost of treatment. If I may just comment on one thing that Amanda stated about the cuts. The reason that there have been cuts in numbers of counselors, et cetera, in all of the methadone treatment centers across the state is because there has been cuts in funding, and Maine now allows a ratio of counselors to patients, which really does not support the patient needs anymore and is really out of line with most of the other states across the nation in having ratios of counselors to patients such that the patients can get the individual treatment that they truly need.
Okay. Amanda, I just had a question for you, and this,
yeah,
some people might find it elucidating. What first got you to treatment?
What first got me into treatment is I knew I had hit a crossroads as to where if I continued on the path that I was on, something terrible was going to happen to me. I was either going to wind up dead or in jail or God knows what. And that's one of the things that led me into treatment. Now, it was what kept me going in and out of treatment. it's not a first time, you know, fail safe mechanism to get off any kind of opiate. You need to, addiction is a process that you need to go through. And again, what led me there the first time is totally different than what led me there the last time. So that's kind of a hard thing to answer. But the last time I had been arrested, and I had gone through the jail thing and the probation, and so I really was at my wit's end. And the last thing that got me into where I am now is my mom looked at me and she said, I had never seen you do so good as to when you were on methadone. And then it clicked, and that was the only thing that worked for me, because again, I have been through the detox centers, the IOPs at Mercy, you know, the Suboxone treatments. I went through it all. But again, the only thing that worked for me was the methadone maintenance treatment because of the stability that you have of when you're going there. And I'm sorry. I'm not sure where I'm trying to go with this. I know that some things work for other people and some things don't. And it's just, addiction is a very, very funny thing. And it leads people down paths they never thought they would go. And it also brings them to places they never thought they would be either. Now I graduated with school, graduated from school. I'm a full-time employee now. And, you know, I'm still in treatment. And I'm working my way out. But there's people that, you know, obviously don't know that I am on methadone. And I would not tell them because of the stigma that comes along with it. And, you know, that's not fair to me, because if you look at the person I am now to the person that I was before, two totally different people. And it took me being in treatment to find who I truly was, and that is the person that I have become.
Amanda, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us. We really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me. I'm sorry, this was all kind of, you know, very fast for me. So I just got a call to do this the other day, so I really wasn't prepared for anything. So I hope my story helps for a few people. And
if I may just add a word, Erwin.
Sure.
Amanda, every time you get up in the morning and you look at yourself in the mirror, you should pat yourself on the back, because no one did this other than you. And yes, physicians and nurses and counselors and therapists, all are supportive, but you were the one who dealt with this directly. And I know your story will be an inspiration to many others. Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking my time.
Okay. Thanks again, Amanda. Have a nice afternoon. Let us go to the phones. We've got some questions coming in. I'm going to start with, I hope I've got this pronounced right, Alana in Standish. Alana, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, just
awesome.
Fine.
Thanks for taking my call. You mentioned a little bit at the beginning of the show that there are more and more babies being born with addiction issues due to so many mothers, young mothers, suffering from addiction. And I was just wondering if you can talk a little bit about specifically methadone use in recovery and then a subsequent pregnancy while you're still on methadone. What are some of the outcomes for those babies? Are they suffering the same types of withdrawal that a baby born addicted to heroin would be suffering?
That's a great question. And there have actually been studies over the years that have addressed that. Methadone is the gold standard of treatment for heroin opiate addicted pregnant women, although buprenorphine also, Suboxone also has been studied lately and also has shown some positive results. If you have a person, for example, who is heroin addicted, they do not go to their prenatal visits, they do not take their prenatal vitamins, they do not eat appropriately, their nutrition is poor. And so there are a lot of factors in addition to the use of heroin that will addict the fetus and the baby that are involved. Once a person gets into methadone treatment, one of the requirements is not only do they get methadone daily to reduce their withdrawal symptoms, and we know that a baby who is not in withdrawal, a fetus that's not in withdrawal, is a healthier baby, and that woman then has improved nutrition, they have their prenatal visits, they have their prenatal vitamins. In both cases, both the heroin-addicted mother who gives birth and the methadone-dependent mother who's in treatment with medication replacement therapy, both of those babies will have withdrawal symptoms, and they both need to be treated upon delivery. But after a year, and studies have been done with methadone mothers on methadone treatment who've delivered babies, and the normal population, there are no significant changes as far as cognitive abilities or developmental stages. There is a difference, though, with the woman who's delivered while on heroin. But again, that may be due to the fact that methadone keeps the woman out of withdrawal, whereas when you're on heroin, because of the half-life of heroin being very short, the mother's constantly in and out of withdrawal. And it may also be a factor of the prenatal care and other factors that I discussed. But that's a great, great question.
All right. Alana, thank you very much. We appreciate that call. We've got some other great questions lined up, too. But before we go there, one of the other things that's true about Dr. Castles is that he is also an author who has written on this subject. But what's interesting is that you have written on this subject in the form of a novel. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, thank you, Erwin. I think when Amanda called in and she talked about the stigma, it was the main reason I wrote the novel, was to destigmatize. I started my career as a board-certified physician in emergency medicine, and it didn't take me long to realize that in some cases and during some ER shifts, more than 50% of people who presented to the emergency department were there related directly or indirectly to the disease of addiction. Now, you might say, my goodness, that seems awfully high, but the kid who comes in with asthma because the father smoked cigarettes, or the automobile accident because someone's intoxicated, or the emphysema patient who smokes, or the alcoholic who has liver disease. I mean, you know, when we look at the disease of addiction, we don't like to call things like our former Vice President Dick Cheney had nicotine addiction. We don't call him an addict. And Mickey Mantle, a beloved hero, baseball player, developed cirrhosis of the liver and liver cancer due to his alcoholism, but we don't call him an alcohol addict. And so what we do is we've defined good addictions and bad addictions, and I don't think there's much difference. And in fact, if you look at the drug medication called naltrexone, which has other different names, it not only decreases cravings in alcoholics, but it also blocks the effects of heroin. So how different are these addictions? So I decided that it was time to put a real face on the disease of addiction, and I wrote a murder mystery legal thriller to try and educate through the back door and to destigmatize the disease. So that is the primary reason I did it. If I put a sign up saying Dr. Castles is going to be speaking tonight on the disease of addiction at the local library, maybe one or two people would show up. And it ended up that the people who did show up knew more about addiction than I did. So I thought that I would try, if I may use the pun, a novel approach. And I hope that it's more widely read. I am donating my author proceeds to treatment centers and to homeless shelters. And medicine has been good to me, and I'd like to give something back.
Okay, and that book is Addiction on Trial, Tragedy in Down East Maine. All right. As I said, we have some more great questions lined up, and we'd still like to hear from you as well. So go ahead and give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can email us, talk@mpbn.net, tweet us at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll take another short break, and then when we return, more of your comments and questions.
Tonight, Lee, the Oscar nominations are out, and they're so white, a grand jury has decided not to indict them.
On the next Fresh Air, Larry Wilmore, host of The Nightly Show, the new program that follows The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Wilmore used to be The Daily Show's senior black correspondent. Join us.
Join us this evening at 7 for Fresh Air.
Okay, welcome. Welcome to The Nightly Show. Oh, thank you very much. All right, calm down.
Next time on The World, a Haitian-American woman rebuilding Haiti, one cocktail at a time.
We created 20 artisanal cocktails that are specific to various regions.
Haitian fruit plus Haitian rum equals Haitian business.
My story is not unique. There are dozens of other Haitian diaspora doing projects that connect with agriculture.
A good news story from Haiti next time on The World.
And you can join us for The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on MPBN Radio. Coming up in just a few minutes at 1 o'clock, ideas from the CBC, The Motorcycle Is Yourself. Robert Pirsig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, An Inquiry into Values, has been called the most widely read book of philosophy ever written. 40 years later, IDEA revisits an interview with the author. The Motorcycle Is Yourself, Ideas from the CBC, coming up at 1 o'clock in just a few minutes right here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back to Maine Calling. Nice to have you with us today on the program. Options for those with an opioid addiction. With me in the studio, Michelle Morin, a registered nurse who works at Merrimack River Medical Services, Stephen Castles.
Correct.
Yeah, there we go. A medical director of community substance abuse centers and the author of Addiction on Trial, Tragedy in Down East Maine. And a couple of things. First, Dr. Castles, we do want to kind of correct, I think, something early on in the program, you were talking about some of the self-inflicted diseases. You mentioned asthma, and we did get someone who wrote in who said it was unfair to categorize all asthma as self-inflicted, and that's probably true.
Absolutely true. Nor did I want to, and many people with pulmonary diseases have a genetic predisposition to it, and they take excellent care of themselves. Same thing could be said about diabetes. Not all people with diabetes are obese or don't take care of themselves nutritionally.
Right. Okay. Let's go back to the phones. Let's talk to Carol in Brunswick. Carol, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to talk about the difference between alcohol addiction and drug addiction. I have many, many family members in recovery, some for decades, and some of them are drug addicts and some of them are alcoholics, but even the drug addicts are alcoholics. However, it's my understanding that anyone who takes an addictive drug, a narcotic addictive drug, will become addicted. But only a certain percentage of people who drink become alcoholics. Some people can drink socially or normally or don't care about it at all, even if they have a drink. And for others, that sets up a problem. So, you know, today, one of the things that is confusing in the recovery community, because so far this program has only talked about treatment, and in the recovery community, my experience has been there are many, 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 many success stories without treatment. And for some, treatment is not affordable, and they have been able to get sober or drug-free through the recovery community, which is free. Now,
let's talk to our guests about this. Michelle, any thoughts?
Well, certainly some people can enter recovery without seeking a treatment facility. But I think, and Amanda made the good point, I think when she called in, how she said she tried several different things, different programs to get into recovery, into a place where she wasn't relapsing. And so I think, again, it's the individual, it's what's going to work for the individual. And certainly there are barriers, monetary barriers, to getting treatment. But just as there isn't one perfect way that's going to fit everybody,
right?
You just have to find what works for you and at different times. Something might work for you today that didn't work for you 5 years ago.
Well, that's absolutely true, Michelle. And the caller brought up some very, very good points, but I'd like to demystify some of this. The alcohol and heroin and cocaine all work through the reward pathway in the brain and all affect an area called the nucleus accumbens. Now, that's a fancy word, but the fact is that there's a similarity between all of it. And the statement that you can have a drink and just be a social drinker, but as soon as you use opiates, you become an addict, is not true. I had rotator cuff surgery. I was given 3 days of Oxycontin. After 3 days, I threw the rest of the Oxycontins away. I disposed of them appropriately. And I am fortunate that I do not have the genetic predisposition to the disease of addiction. So to say that alcohol is different than opiates, I think, is a mischaracterization. It is true that many people who are on opiates also drink. It's also true that some people who drink try opiates. The success rate without treatment, there's no question that there is no one way to treat any disease, and that for some with lower levels of dependency, and at some point we can talk, maybe not today, we don't have time, of tolerance, dependency, and addiction. There's a difference between dependency and addiction. But with lower levels of tolerance, there's no question that some people do not need medication replacement, but no different than the person with the disease of alcoholism who's drank excessively and is now in acute withdrawal and has the DTs and can die from that. They need some replacement therapy, whether it be a benzodiazepine, phenobarbital, some sort of sedative that will allow them not to have their seizures, the hypertensive crisis, et cetera. The same could be said for the reason that you use methadone or suboxone is to take away the withdrawal symptoms. So this is really an hour conversation, but some great, great questions. And I hope that at least I've addressed some of the issues related to your questions.
All right, great. Carol, thank you very much for the call. Brian posted to our Facebook page an interesting question. If Maine has such a higher rate of addiction than most states, he wonders how much of the problem might be caused by DOs, doctors of osteopathy, overprescribing compared to MDs overprescribing?
That's not a question that I can answer. I have never seen any statistics on that. We do need to understand that the training for a person who's an osteopathic physician and a rather than a medical physician is very, very similar. And in fact, my understanding that the doctors of osteopathy actually have an additional year for understanding the anatomy of the body and manipulative techniques better. So I do not believe that's a true statement, and I don't know if there's a source that is referred to that.
Okay, very good. Let's go back to the phones. This is Robert in Lincolnville. Robert, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, everybody. Bear with me. This is actually a little bit of exposure therapy for me.
Okay.
To call in and not be too nervous to actually do so. The same thing when I speak in meetings, and it's been wonderful to be in recovery. But I did want to ask, with regard to alcohol, there's a big debate, or at least there was a debate in the past, saying that some alcohol, you know, not every alcoholic's the same, just as you guys have pointed out with regard to other types of addiction. And I'm wondering what your feelings are about the possibility of some alcoholics, after recovery, being able to take a little bit of controlled drinking. And I'll take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
That's a fantastic question. There actually is a debate right now as far as can somebody who has the disease of alcoholism be able, once in recovery, to drink in moderation? That's really what the question is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the answer is that we are all not the same, that we are all individuals, and I believe that it's based upon our genetic predisposition, our psychological components, our sociological environment. As a physician, I would highly recommend that if you can live without drugs or alcohol and you've shown a predisposition to drink or use drugs excessively, that you should stay away from it. That would be my advice. But to say that there is nobody in the world that suffers from the disease of alcoholism who has consumed alcohol excessively and now can no longer ever have a drink, I wouldn't go that far.
All right. Let's go to Kevin in Portland. Kevin, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I'd like to ask the panel what they think the cause of addiction is.
Okay, straightforward question.
Three components, biological, psychological, and sociological. And I'll give you a couple of quick examples. From a biological point of view, we know from Scandinavian studies many years ago that if you take twins who are adopted and you place those twins both from alcoholic families and non-alcoholic families, and you place those twins into families that have the disease of alcoholism or are an actively drinking family versus those that aren't, the most powerful determinant on whether those kids will be, which of those children will become alcoholics, is a genetic predisposition based upon what their parents were. From a psychological point of view, we have people who have the disease, who have anxiety, and lots of people who have anxiety, for example, like to use alcohol because it has a calming effect. We know that some people with other types of mental challenges and illnesses such as bipolar disease, sometimes they prefer to use opiates, that people who are depressed tend to use cocaine. So there's a psychological component to this as well. And then there's a sociological aspect, which I would like to emphasize, if I can, just in a minute. We know it's very difficult to keep people in recovery when you do not change their sociological environment. There were many Vietnam War vets who came back who were addicted to heroin. But because we were able to remove them from their sociological environment, i.e. the war zone and Vietnam, they had a higher success rate of being able to stay off of heroin when they returned to the United States in treatment with both methadone and Suboxone. At the time, years ago, was not a medication very readily used. And so I think that speaks to the fact that we need to deal with the issue of addiction and not just on the biological, medical, and psychological aspects, but also on a societal level as well.
It makes me also want to ask you something else. I was reading one of your blog posts where you talked about the fact that one of the things we really needed to do is deal with the demand side of drug abuse. And you mentioned perhaps, you know, some kind of increased public awareness campaign. And I guess I was kind of wondering, what would it say to people?
Well, it's interesting. I think, Erin, when you're referring to the blog post where I said that our public officials should spend as much money on public service announcements about the disease of addiction as we see commercials for Viagra and Cialis.
Exactly.
And if that would be the case, we could really educate people. What it would deal with is destigmatizing the disease. We see commercials that says if you have nicotine addiction, there's Nicorette gum, there's Nicorette patch, you can go for counseling, it's okay. If you have a pulmonary disease due to it, there's treatment. You don't need to be embarrassed about it. I think what the public service announcements would say is you don't need to be embarrassed if you're a heroin addict or an OxyContin addict. And here's the places where you can get treatment. Here's support groups. Here's government funding to help you, and that it can make a difference, and to have people like Amanda be a spokesperson. The reason you don't see a lot of heroin addicts speaking about heroin is because the stigma in society that they have a bad addiction and the alcoholic has a good addiction.
All right. Let's go to John in Norwich Walk. John, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to make a statement, okay?
Okay.
I was a police officer in New Jersey for 9 years, 2.5 years up here. And to me, incarceration is not the answer. We have to do something with the I think what your hosts are saying is the right avenue. And people don't understand how serious it is with these people with their addiction, okay? When you see it recidive, you know, they're coming back all the time. And the lifestyle and the gutter that they actually live in is horrible. And I feel that, you know, hats off to these people like your two hosts and also like the governor of Vermont. I think that's the way to go because incarceration is not the answer. And there has to be more accepting of these people, even though they have a bad habit. And that's the only way we're going to do it is when we start looking at them as people that have a sickness and go from there. And I thank you very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, sir, for the call. We appreciate it. I guess perhaps lastly, this was an email that came in, a question from Lewis. Can people be addicted and still function and get done what needs to be done so that their addiction does not interfere with everyday living, functioning, or being responsible? Michelle?
Well, I think what happens is you can function for a little while, and then what precipitates the realization that you need some help and start to seek recovery is all of those pieces start to fall down around you. You can hold it together for a while, but eventually the addiction, the love of whatever that addiction is, and it's not just opiates we're talking about here, but whatever you happen to be addicted to becomes everything to you because it's all important that you get it. And that's when you see everything else that was stable in your life starts to fall down around you. And that's when you start alienating your family and your loved ones. and you start to have those difficulties where you realize that you need some help. You need somebody to help you get out of that.
But that does not mean, though, that we don't see people every day, whether they be politicians, physicians, teachers, students, carpenters, who are functioning while addicted to alcohol and opiates. So, yes, there are functional addicts in our society, but it's not the healthy way to go.
All right. That will do us. Steve and Michelle, both, thank you very much for joining us today. Michelle Morin is a registered nurse who works at Merrimack River Medical Services. Dr. Stephen Kessels is the medical director of Community Substance Abuse Centers and the author of Addiction on Trial, Tragedy in Down East Maine. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Our intern Moses Small answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our podcasts by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Erwin Gratz, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.